where we talk about alien visitation, Atlantis, a lot of the...
genetic manipulation.
I was getting around it without giving the title of the book, which we'll give later. But you can also visit his website at www.taroscopes.com. His name is Michael Zirin. He's from Ireland. So we'll welcome him aboard. Hi, Michael. You with us?
Yes, indeed, Jay. Nice to be here.
Great.
Fantastic.
It's good to have you.
Welcome to our show, Michael.
Absolutely. It's been following your site, and I love your site, so it was wonderful that we had the opportunity to talk together.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for being on.
Tell our listeners, give us some background here. I know a lot of the stuff that you have to say about Atlantis and where the technology comes from is involved with this idea of alien visitation over the years.
Right, and you know, obviously that does follow on from the work of Eric von Däniken, who's a big hero of mine, and certainly Zachariah Sitchin, and a lot of the people who've been looking into this. My work specifically maybe follows the thread of, say, William Bramley, who went a little bit deeper, you know, into the more controversial areas of this kind of thing, because the two things that really concern me, Jay, about the subject of visitation is because, I mean, a lot of people have talked about that. I mean, Einstein, Sagan, it's not that that's a new topic, you know, and even big blockbuster movies have been made. But to me, the idea is that, okay, we talk about the technology, we talk about, you know, Atlantis and the buildings, and what the civilization may have been like. But the thing that was missing to me is what was the psychological consequences to mankind if indeed such a kind of visitation took place. The Zachariah Sitchin, you know, and most of the scholars do not talk about this. They are most interested in deciphering the old scrolls and deciphering the old texts and even getting funding to, say, maybe dig up some physical. You know, the whole thing is it's very physical. It's very practical, and I can understand that because they want everyone in the world to accept.
Oh, yeah. Now,
of course,
Zachariah Sitchin, he's the Russian scientist that did some work with the whole Earth Changes Planet X theory. Am I correct?
Absolutely correct. You know, and then we have, you know, friends of mine like Graham Hancock who've literally taken cameras, you know, and filmed these gigantic, you know, structures under the sea. So I think that we right now in history, and then we have shows like your own show, you know, so I think we're at the time in history where it cannot be doubted anymore that something bloody extraordinary was going on, you know, X amount of years ago, before 7,000 years ago, before the dates of history that are put in front of us. There's no doubt in anybody's mind now, at least a rational person, that obviously there were these pre-diluvian, pre-flood civilizations. But you see, again, that's like having a lot of different pieces of the jigsaw. You know, we filmed this here, we can film the Nazca lines from the sky. You know, how many times have people photographed the pyramid? You know, I mean, we understand that something bizarre has been going on this planet. We find ancient crystal, which glass, which is, you know, 6,000 years old. We find steel that the Smithsonian has dated as being, you know, made in temperatures of 9,000 degrees Celsius, which never could, history has always said that could never happen. So we got crystal skulls, we got the Maya calendar, we got all of these idioms that show us that something bizarre was going on this planet. But nobody has really addressed then, okay, what about if there was a visitation, if we had super advanced people on this planet who did create these civilizations, who did have super weaponry, all the rest of it, what does it mean for us now? You know, these guys are obviously not walking around on the Earth right now, so where's the disconnect? And then also, what would it have meant for the human psyche? This is what sort of distinguishes my work, as I look more at the psychological aspects of this visitation.
Okay, that's definitely an angle that I don't think the other names have covered.
Now, I want to take a pause for a minute and tell anybody all these clicks you're hearing in the background. That's the Winston-Salem Journal is in here with us in the studio tonight.
Yep.
They're doing a story on our show.
Taking our
wonderful mug shots. So you can see that it is true that if you have a great voice on radio, you are ugly.
Yes.
You'll see our pictures.
You will see that we're the two ugliest guys on the OmniSound
Radio 1 network. And you can call in here and speak with us and Michael tonight. Call our toll-free number. It's 800-960-2289, 800-960-2289, or locally at 336-996-1596. Michael, how does what your all the research that you've done, how does all this play in with some other theories that are similar, stuff like, you know David Icke, you know some of the work that he's done?
Good question. And David's a good friend, and I've contributed to his books, The Children of the Matrix and The Biggest Secret, in the past before I did my own book. And in fact, your question is most appropriate because it's not that I have some major problems with David's work. It's just that in everybody's work, you know, and especially when you contribute to their work, you kind of get frustrated because, you know, they miss out on certain parts. And then I've been vocalizing this and, again, reading a lot and then saying, my God, why does this guy not deal with this and why does that guy not deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
And, again, as I said, the big missing picture was this whole missing psychological aspect about the cruelty and injustice that exists in our own mind. So basically then what happened is I had been reading a lot of these people, like we do, and coming up with what might be called the X factors in their work. Not because I have necessarily a problem with their work, it's just that I would be noticing these things that they wouldn't go into, that they weren't addressing, and then I'd be taking notes of that. And also be taking notes of some of the more wild, you know, disinformationalist books that were also out there. Naming no names right now, of course, but then so my book kind of got created out of the X factors of all of these other people's books. It got created out of frustration about the stuff that they were not addressing, and then instead of, you know, keep on contributing to their work, it's like the time came and said, wait a minute, why don't I just do my own bloody work and then get it over with, you know, because, you know, steering others and helping others and contributing as a researcher, you know, that's good up to a point. But you can't get into the brain of the author and then, you know, and really re-hardwire them. So the best thing to do is to do your own work. And it took a lot of time because I'm not necessarily a person who had that plan. You know, I've said this before, I didn't have the actual plan to sit down and write a book, you know. That was not really of my great interest at that, especially in this subject.
Okay.
But there are differences, and, you know, I can go through a few of them for you if you want. I mean, my first difference is that, and this ties in very much with what David Icke is doing, is that I do not believe, first of all, I do believe that this visitation took place. I do not believe that the visitation was through some sort of celestial brotherhood, you know, who came here to benefit the human race. I do not believe that there was anything positive about this visitation. So David and I and one or two others are definitely on the same page there. The next thing I believe is that the great cosmic upheavals that are now even Western scientists are proving existed and have been known through all the ages, you know, to the different tribes, the great upheavals, the flood and the pole shift and all of these things, I differ variously from every one of them because I do not believe that that was created by some interfering comet or from some, you know, careering meteorite or whatever. I believe that that was created by humanoid action through a kind of a war of the gods type scenario. And therefore, that is I'm unique in that I believe that the destruction of the great planet out there that created the asteroid belt is, in fact, action that wasn't just of nature.
Uh-huh.
That all of these earth changes of the past that people are talking about were humanoid action was involved, let's just say that. The other thing that I think that I differ with is that there's a couple of other points, if we have time we can go into it. It's I think that there's a missing variable because obviously anyone that you talk to about this subject, that hey, there was, you know, visitations in the ancient past, that we may have even had flying crafts and great civilizations, they're going to say, well, where is that all now? Then you say, well, okay, there was earth devastation, there was catastrophe. But there's still going to be a question that if you say there was a war of the gods, you know, 11,000 years ago or whatever, how come we don't see the results of that right away? How come there's been a delay? So my book and my work definitely deals with the delay factor. Why did the war of the gods get delayed, and why is it that we're neither good or just evil in the world? You know, why is there both?
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be some delay in the outcome situation. Now, the other interesting thing is that I do not believe that evil, that thing that we have, you know, to deal with in the world pretty much every day, sadism, injustice, cruelty, you know, all of the above, the unbelievable amount of brutality that exists in the world, I do not believe that those instincts are natural to man. I believe that those came about through the genetic interference with the biology of our forefathers that I talk about in the book. And that definitely is something also that distinguishes my work, that the inner stress and angst that people have psychologically, plus the social, you know, injustice and violence and cruelty and all of that that we see, is also alien to the human being. It's actually part of the alien aspect. And, you know, I think that when it comes to the reptilians, I don't believe that they were visitors. I believe they were actually created here on Earth.
Uh-huh.
When it comes to the Bible and the biblical serpent, I have a whole new take on that, which involves that the serpent was in fact an enlightener to Eve.
Okay.
The Bible and the Christian hegemony turned that around in order to demonize Eve and to demonize the serpent so that we would not understand that there was actually a dragon court or a serpent race, in the same way that William Bramley talks about the brotherhood of the snake, that there's actually an order on this planet that descends from ancient times who's in control of the thrones of government and religion.
So
they go by the name the serpents.
So you believe, you're following kind of the David Icke line, and also a line that I know Clyde Lewis has talked about before, with a whole idea of basically an Illuminati that's controlled by reptilian beings then from...
Well, reptilians do not control the Illuminati. The reptilians themselves are under control of the first generation of visitors who are not reptilian. The first generation of visitors that came here, the Nephilim or the fallen angels, the ones that the ancient texts talk about, are not themselves reptilian. They are humanoid. They were humanoid. Now, they created the reptilians here as a sort of a slave race. So when people are telling you about the reptilians, they're quite right. But when they're telling you that these reptilians are themselves invaders from outside our Earth, that is not, in fact, true at all.
Okay.
They've got a missing piece.
now, you've got a show coming up, don't you, on the Sci-Fi channel, I believe?
Yeah, Sci-Fi are doing their NBC special on Atlantis in July 9th. Which is going to be like their Bermuda Triangle two-hour special that they did last year, which was, it was the most watched show in sci-fi history.
Oh, wow.
And Tim Beecham, the producer of that show, was very eager to go one step forward and do something on Atlantis, which he was also interested in. And he came across my work. And then, do you remember that New York had that power outage like a couple of months ago?
Yeah.
The whole damn city was on standstill or whatever? He had the opportunity then to really sit down and read my book, because as you know, time is short and producers often don't really have the time to really get into a particular person's work.
Oh, yeah.
Well, during that power outage, you know, he couldn't move. So he read through the book. He knew about the book. He knew about me, but he read it more distinctly and then was really, really captivated and very enthusiastic about not just doing a, you know, a couple of anecdotal things about me, but actually doing a segment. So yeah, he was very... It was a wonderful opportunity. It was a great time. They came out and filmed me to really do justice to the ideas, you know. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm well happy. It was a very, very good interview and a lot of interest in the actual theories, which is remarkable because, you know, my work is very controversial. It's not mainstream. But Sci-Fi Channel, you know, I've taken an interest and, you know, just want to see how they play it. Because, as I said, I think we're in a different age right now. We're in an age where people are really clamoring for answers. They're a little bit more able to look at more of the controversial aspect of things and get their heads around some of the more bizarre, you know, anomalies that are coming forward in this world.
So is NBC...
I look at that as very positive.
I'm sorry, is NBC carrying this as well as Sci-Fi then, or...?
Yeah, it'll be...
Okay.
It'll be July 9th is the release.
July 9th, all right.
July 9th is okay. The official... Of course, they'll be previewing it themselves, you know.
Okay.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Basically, you talk about the alien visitation a long, long time ago. I don't want to make any parallels here, but you know that show Stargate,
yeah.
You know, where Ron, you know, the ancient Egyptian gods or whatever are basically, I know it's so cheesy, but I mean, there's a certain amount of truth to it.
Yeah,
I
mean, that if these are visitations, you know, a long time ago, then our ancestors couldn't help but think, oh my God, you know, these people are, or they're godlike beings. And
yeah.
In that case, following that parallel, a lot of ancient elder gods, basically, in my book, tended to be very cruel and you know, required very cruel things from people, like sacrifices and, you know, blood rituals and stuff like that. You can go with the Mayans, you can go with the Phoenicians, you can go with any number of cultures. Basically, you would say that those elder gods are manifestations or the actual visitors themselves, right?
Yeah, there's no question in my mind about that. You put it in a nutshell brilliantly, because this is where my work very much focuses, is on the darker side of these visitations, not on this whole thing that they're like these Flash Gordons come here to help us become civilized and, you know, help us to dig wells and fix bones and teach us language and all that malarkey. You know, my reading on it is very much from these kinds of sources where people have a doubt about it, because why would these ancient races then be so bloodthirsty? You know, why would all the records be talking about an enormous war, a blood ritual? Why are we participating in these exactly kind of things today? About the movies, you're absolutely correct. Movies like Fifth Element, The Matrix, Stargate, you know, Underworld, Blade, you know, the list goes on. Hellboy, which I really like. You know, there's a lot of movies that contain a lot of information, because I believe that the descendants of these people, who I always advocate, are still in control of the world. I like to give us updates about what is actually going on. It's just part of their own ritual, that they have to give the sheep, as it were, updates about what is really going on in the occult, you know, behind the theater, the occult underground world. And the movies and advertisements and symbolism is the way they do it. They're not going to come out and say it in words, so one needs to understand some of the symbolism that is being involved and look into this whole picture, because the ancient books have said that these individuals that came here did not want to come here, and they certainly didn't want to stay as long, but they were forced to stay here. There was things that happened where they actually became interned on this planet in a kind of a quarantine type situation, based on either, some people say, the divine force quarantined this planet in order to keep their kind of evil machinations in. That's a religious rendering of the problem. Others say, no, it was the pursuers of these Nephilim characters who actually erected a barrier around our Earth in order to keep them in, and that for the last 11,000 years or more, they've been seeking to get out of this internment, in exactly the same way as the Book of Revelation talks about the, you know, the great serpent being chained to the pit.
Right.
And in ancient mythologies, we have the same idea of being incarcerated. It's a very old mythological motif.
Oh, okay.
That number again is 800-960-2289. Call and speak with Michael Zarian. The name of his book is Atlantis, Alien Visitation and Genetic Manipulation. You can go to his website also. That's terrascopes.com. Or you can go to our upcoming guest page, and you can click on a link there, and it'll take you to his website.
Okay. I actually have a follow-up question to this. Basically, also pulling from the old sources, you know, the old historical text. I mean, there are a lot of stories cross-culturally, if you will. I mean, in some respects, like the, you know, the Quetzalcoatl myth, that, you know, it's a benevolent creature, but also you have the notion of dragons, for example, and the Epic of Gilgamesh, where Gilgamesh slays, you know, and Enkidu slay Tiamat, and St. George, you know, defeats the dragon. You know, there are a lot of stories of these reptilian figures and humans, it seems like, general humans, that, you know, go after them and hunt them down and try to attack them. What do you make of that?
Yes, that can be read on all levels, because it's a worldwide myth. I know I always tell people that I treat the myths as reverently and as factually as most scientists would treat their own paradigms. And I think we all need to get our minds around that when we're reading stuff in the myths, apart from a little embellishment here and there, I believe we are meant to take those myths as very accurate. So when they're talking about the, you know, the famous knight or the hero, that in order to prove himself, he's got to go and knock on the door of some hideous monster and slay him so that he can wear the image of that, you know, dragon on a shield, and all these medieval tales, and then going even further back to the Epic of Gilgamesh that you're talking about, and all throughout the world, you'll hear Indra, you know, Indra having to go and fight the many-headed serpent.
Right, right.
Or what's his name? Hercules having to fight the seven-headed Hydra.
Right.
And all the rest of it. And where's all this coming from? You know, you think our forefathers just sitting around the fire shooting the breeze with nothing better to do, and then they'd all come up with the same exact story all throughout the world? No, no. This is very much based on something that really happened, and it can be interpreted in psychological or physical context, and both would be right. I believe there was physical encounters with such beings up until very recently, in fact, where there these beings, these hybrid creatures, and I mean the unicorn, the minotaur, the centaur, the siren, you know, the dragon being, all of the above, I believe, existed physically. But then because, of course, that man now has alien DNA, the mythology of fighting the dragon could be interpreted also psychologically, that he is fighting the darker side of his own being. You know, so both systems work. Both interpretations are right. But what has happened, you know, is that most historians who deal with this information tend, for safety's sake, to always interpret it along the psychological grounds only, so that it's kind of safe. That, oh, yes, this is just man's dark side, blah, 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 and that fits in very well with the, you know, the religious idea that man is born in original sin and has to fight off the devil and the dragon. And they tend to downplay completely the fact that this may have been a physical phenomenon in the world.
They were really...
You need to realize that the myths are talking about physical phenomena.
Yeah, they were really fighting dragons.
Here's a question I have for you, Michael. You're from Ireland.
Right.
And I want to know about the leprechaun and fairy thing. Is that something that you believe existed at one time, still exists today?
It's a remnant. It's what's
it's
called
a
relic, an old relic. I'm from actually Northern Ireland, Belfast, just to clear that up.
Okay.
You know, there's this north and the south, but...
You're from the war-torn area, then?
Yeah, from Belfast City, which is very war-torn, exactly right.
Okay.
Which ties in a lot to how I got into all of this stuff, but anyway, to answer your question, yes, these, like the King Under the Mountain in Scandinavian mythology, the idea of the goblins, the elves, the dwarves. You know, elva is a Scandinavian Swedish word, the elves meaning the white ones or the pure ones or the shining ones. All the terms that we find in these ancient mythologies refer to beings from under the earth. Because what you're talking about now includes the fact that these individuals, these entities or whatever, you can't read about them without also discovering that they're from under the Earth, this whole phenomenon of the hollow Earth, which plays up very largely in ancient mythology. So, yeah, I believe that these individuals did exist. They were either hybrid creatures of the past, in exactly the same way today as a mother and an ordinary mother and father can give birth to a freak or a two-headed Siamese twin and all of the above. In fact, I don't know if the world is aware of this, about how common it is that people do, in fact, give birth to very strange-looking children who are then tucked away in the back wards of insane asylums. It's one of the horrific things that we do on this planet. And a lot of people are not aware of this and what goes on in hospitals and so on, but that's the side. The interesting thing is, yes, there are definitely throwbacks to genetic hybridization that are happening in this world. There was strange creatures before. They were either totally indigenous to the planet, they may have been the original life forms, or they may have been, in the way Tolkien perhaps says, they are results of the great hybridization processes that happen on this planet. But you cannot disassociate them from Hollow Earth. Now, one final anecdote about Hollow Earth is that the word hollow is the word that gave rise to the word holy. So in ancient, when the Christians came along, they would then build their churches and their houses and their palaces and a lot of the state homes over the entrances of these hollow earth sites all over the world. Because, of course, they didn't want people to then go there to pray and go there to listen to the oracle and go there to do their rituals. They wanted to get in the way of that. And then people go, there's no such thing as hollow earth. We don't see any of these entrances. Well, of course you don't, because you're looking right at it, but you don't see it. You see a church or a cathedral or a stately home, and you don't realize what's under there. These people deliberately built over these places. So then in ancient times, when they said, let's go to the hollow place, let's go to the hollow place, it then became later, let's go to the holy place. The holy, H-O-L-Y, is originally a throwback to the old hollow place where people used to go for counsel because they knew that's where the gods live. And if you're good enough, the oracle will come up and answer your problems and fix your wounds and tell you stories and all the rest of it. These are the old, you know, patterns and cultures that the myths still talk about.
That's true. You know, actually, I have a very quick story about this, you know, giving birth to a freak. My mom used to work in the baby's ward at over there in Raleigh-Durham quite a number of years ago, and she told me this rather disturbing tale of a mother that gave birth, no kidding, Scott, gave birth to this creature, and it was not a human creature. In fact, she said it reminded her of a frog. Like, the face was very flat, the fingers were webbed. It even, I wouldn't say it had a greenish skin color, but I mean, the thing looked, it did not look human at all.
It was completely alien. Exactly.
And,
you're getting these backwoods of North Carolina, though. You never know.
This is Raleigh-Durham, dude. But, you know, and the thing was, they took that creature away, and to tell you the truth, she never found out what became of it. She assumed that it had passed away because, you know, there were other kind of miscarriages and, you know, drug-related births that would create such things.
But the NSA walked it on.
I don't know. I mean,
No, the hospitals are run by the Knights Templars. Hospitals are 100% exclusively run by the Knights Templars. The Knights Templars were the ones who originally wore the white robes with the red cross on
it.
Make no mistake about it. There's been enormous injustices taking place in this planet through hospitals, and they have a particular secret rite that whenever a mother does give birth to a child, they either swap the child in exactly the same way as the Damien movie, the first movie. You have to watch that movie again.
We've actually
with eyes because they let you know that they do that.
We've actually got an actor, Marshall Kupp, from the new remake of The Omen. He's going to be on the show. Is that next week or the week after, Trent?
It's
It's either next week or the week after.
I think it's next week.
I wonder. It'd be interesting to see if the new movie goes into this particular anecdote. Fascinating when the two characters, remember, were hunting for the child. They go to the Italian hospital, and in the movie, they actually let you know subliminally that children are replaced.
It was just an interesting little anecdote.
Now, how does this tie in, Michael, to the idea of the Antichrist? I know that Clyde Lewis, who follows a lot of David Icke stuff, and does that with the whole reptilian agenda, the idea of a new world order? Do you believe that the Antichrist is someone that they're going to use or try to use? And do you believe that this person is already alive today?
Well, no, I believe that the Antichrist is a throwback to an old, it's a very bad throwback. The word is terrible. It really is very misleading. But I think the original principle, outside of its religious context, was that it was to do with the elite, you know, group of 9 or group of 30 or whatever of the original Nephilim and perhaps their direct descendants in the bloodline of the dragon line, the controllers of the world, the people at the top of the pyramid. So I don't think Antichrist is kind of misleading because it brings you into all sorts of religious connotation, as if Christianity was the only coterie fighting these particular kinds of beings. That's very misleading, because evil in this world, as we are talking about on this show, and as I do in the book, is, you know, we're talking 50,000 years ago, 11,000 years ago. My goodness, Christianity, Islam, you know, Judaism, these things are recent in history. So how could then the birth of evil that we're talking about merely start with the birth of Jesus Christ or Muhammad? So one thing we have to get clear is that although we may be using Christian and terminology that would be understood to the masses of the world who follow the three major religions, my goodness, the evil that we're talking about is many millennia older than that, and the contingent who's been fighting that those forces is also older.
We have a call. Hang
tight a second, Michael. We've got a caller. Hello, caller. You're on World of the Unexplained. Where are you calling from?
Florida.
Okay. What's your question for Michael?
Yeah, I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit about the event that took place, according to this book, about 13,000 years ago, having to do with women and the punishment that they're going through, and what kind of power they actually had back then.
Yes, this is most important. Earlier, when Jay, you were asking me what distinguishes my work, the caller has brought up probably one of the most important aspects of it, is the role of women, who, of course, have not held proper office and who have been segmented into this role as if they're non-technological and all the rest of it. And it goes back to the event of, to make it simple, the Garden of Eden story, the simplistic idea that Eve was blamed for the sins of mankind. The true story of that, very briefly, is that the Eves were, in fact, the first rebel. When the Adams and Eves, and believe me, they weren't just two individuals. We're talking about a coterie here. We're talking about a race of slaves. It was the Eves that actually helped the Adams to move themselves out of the slavery of the Garden of Eden that the Atlantean warlocks had put them under. And as part of this rebellion, they actually moved. They actually physically relocated to the continent of Lemuria, which was always a rival continent to Atlantis. And on that continent, that's where the great cults of power, the Wicca, and I would say that the female cults of power, where the female was also an initiator, the female held office, the female developed clairvoyant powers, the female was the one who also developed a lot of the healing powers that we still have today, the whole idea of herbs and, you know, the old, the grandmothers being interested in the herbs and the healing, all of these different cultures that, of course, Christianity was still rising up against these people in the Middle Ages. But take this back maybe, 50,000 years ago or 11,000 years ago and 30,000 years ago, it's a whole different dynamic in which the females were the initiators and the keepers of the light, as well as these high Lemurians. And, of course, the whole subject of the female being downtrodden and kept to be marginalized originates from this particular time. And it's very important to the ruling coterie that women do not have, you know, the same kind of office to discover what has been hidden from them and to kind of understand what kind of power that they had before in the early times.
Okay.
Michael,
thanks, caller.
We're going to have to take a short break. It'll be about a little over 4 minutes. But if you'll hang on the line, we'll be back. And you're listening to World of the Unexplained. And we'll be back in just a moment with Michael Zarian.
See you in a bit.
Women have today is based on this much lower level enhancement of the power that they used to wield on a spiritual level. It's the same reason why in the Arthurian legends, you know, the legends of old are coming down with powerful mythological, like Queen Guinevere and see Morgane Le Fay, you know, and as time goes by, of course, then you start getting it into the demonic side, that they've demonized the female so badly that then she becomes the temptress, she becomes the challenger, she becomes the Eve, you know, and the Lilith, and the Gorgon and the Medusa and all of these corrupted versions, because, of course, unless you have a corrupted temptress type of evil individual, then the solar hero that's put before us by Christianity and the solar cult, they can't look as great and handsome and wonderful unless you have the demon side as well. So as things got corrupted down through time, then you had this awful schism that has, you know, still basically being played out today.
Okay.
Awesome.
Well, I guess then what advantage would it? Yeah, what advantage would the? What would be the motivations and the greater purpose for them to downplay women? And
well, that I think is again a major central theme of my work. Is this that focuses on that thing about the hidden variable that I deal with a lot? Because of course there has been a delay. There was an ancient war of the gods, and then there's some sort of delay. And I always point to the delay being the pole shift, which was something that happened that neither side ever really knew that was going to happen. I think it's probably because they didn't have too great a knowledge of this planet and how it would react to their war. And I believe that the pole shift that has now been confirmed to have happened about 13,500 years ago and the awful calamities there were the variable that prevented the Nephilim from exiting the planet. And so I believe, as strange as it may sound, that for the last 11,000 years, their one concern, and I mean it's the cardinal concern, and then all the other concerns are mere satellite concerns, is how to vacate this planet, this address. It's not a home to them. They didn't want to come here in the first place. They don't like it. They don't like us. They're sick and tired of it. And when I'm talking about them, I mean the descendants, not the originals. And the whole idea of the space race and the intense move of technology that has been happening down through the thousands of years is part of this occult agenda in order to get the technology back that was lost when the great continents of old sank. This is a variable that nobody else seems to deal with. And then we're talking, you know, 11,000 years later, we're picking up on this subject, and I'm going, hang on a minute, you haven't even answered the main issue. What on earth is going on? What's going on is that we have our empires and our technological zeal being artificially motivated and pushed forward. We have history being manipulated and put forward. We've got every country in the world, you know, becoming tentacles of the British government and the seats of power of the Nephilim so that they can get the ore and they can get the minerals and they can get the silicon, because these were enormously advanced technological beings. And they want to get back to the point where they have that technology available to them again. And we are now living in the age, which is why this work is so important to get known about. We're actually living in the age in which these people are doing a pretty good job for themselves. They're slowly building back the kind of technology that will allow them to space travel again, to maybe break through the Stargate and vacate this planet. And this is the occult agenda that I've discovered is of primary concern to them. And, you know, another interesting thing is, because I see that you have some very interesting information on your website about vampires.
Oh, yeah.
When it comes to the War of the Gods, we also, there's another fascinating thing that has never been brought forward. It ties into the idea of the freaks that we were just talking about, is that there's another action to any kind of global nuclear war, and that is the fallout and the radiation. So what happens, in my work, I've discovered that the fallout and the radiation from a global war like that must also be taken into consideration, because the radiation on the planet of that much intensity changes the physical form. So in the legends of old, when we're hearing about these hybrid creatures, and we've already talked about them, but when we're hearing about the giants and men of great strength, when we're hearing about vampires who need blood to live on because, you know, their biology is totally messed up and they're anemic, when we hear about the blue color of the gods, or that they are hybrid, they have several arms or several eyes, when we hear about even the dinosaurs, there's recent theories now that the dinosaurs are much more modern than we've been told. Well, then what would account for the giantism in certain animals like that? What would account for the clairvoyant abilities that certain people started to develop after the War of the Gods? Could this not be hideous effects of the fallout and the radiation that is causing a lot of the anomalies? And if it is, then we can answer to people who are very skeptical, saying, "Oh, look, how can we believe any of these stories about hideous monsters and giants walking here and there, and Sasquatch and the Yeti and all of this nonsense? Can't you see that this is irrational, you know, crap? Wake up." Well, wait a minute. No. Scientifically, you can prove that these kind of characteristics, the fact that the gods and the reptilians had to live underground and couldn't stand the sunlight, that they had to give birth in private, that certain hideous beings were being born, that the changeling, you see, and some of these other beings, small beings and big beings, what would happen? Let's just pose the question. If these monstrosities were caused and some psychic ability started to open up from the dire effects of the radiation poisoning that happened during the fallout, you know, the aftermath of the War of the Gods, this is another piece that has not even been investigated at all. Huh. And I think is very important.
Well, certainly.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to ask a question about Atlantis, but
well, yeah, I was kind of going that way too. But I mean, maybe not Atlantis, but I really actually was kind of. I wanted to talk a little more about Lemuria. I mean, Atlantis. I mean, we hear about it a lot, you know, that from the old Greek stories. But I mean, Lemuria. Honestly, I have to say I don't know a whole lot about. So, if you don't mind, well, let's talk about that for a second.
Well, again, you know, my work is to clear up a lot of disinformation, and one of the areas of disinformation is that there was just one continent that sank, and they've downplayed entirely the four other continents, specifically Oceania or Lemuria, which used to be called Oceania as well. This was in the south, where Hawaii, Thursday Island, Australia, New Zealand, even probably a lot of Antarctica. I think they're hesitant to be digging around, or at least publicly digging around in Antarctica, because they know what they'll find. They'll find the remnants of an enormous civilization that was down there. And I think that Graham Hancock, his filming off the coast of Ceylon, which your own American Arthur C. Clarke already had noted, was an ancient, the people there were talking about Silipa Darkan, the ancient islands from which they've come, and now he's been filming it. Off the coast of Ceylon, they've discovered enormous underground rivers, underground roads, all the rest of it. These are remnants of the great continent of Lemuria, in which the progeny of the Atlanteans left, and they moved there. They moved there to set up their own thriving civilization. On that continent, I believe, Lemuria just means the homeland, the motherland of humanity. And it was on that continent, and in that rival civilization, that the alien genes were going to be worked out through time. They were either going to physically, scientifically, genetically try to tweak it so that it would be less effective, or they were going to do it through conditioning down through the ages. And of course, after the war and the destruction of these continents, that program got stopped. So in fact, we now inherit a major alien strain in our DNA because it wasn't conditioned out as much as it maybe could have been under the Lemurian epoch. I believe that when you have the great geniuses of the world, especially those who are more free-thinking and questioning, I believe that it's a humanoid DNA that is stronger. Perhaps these people actually are the forefathers of such people, like the Mozarts and the Beethovens and what have you. These individuals may actually have been genetically related to Lemuria as opposed to Atlantis. Because in my thinking, the remnants of Atlantis set up their new thriving civilizations in the Middle East, in Sumeria, Babylon, and they have a very strong alien proclivity. And that's where the bloodlust you see in the territorialism and the war and the conquest. And I'm even finding out now that I think that there was a very powerful alien strain had set itself up in Egypt. First of all, I didn't think that. I thought that Egypt was pretty pure. But as I'm researching more for my new book, The Irish Origins of Civilization, I'm coming to think that, in fact, there was a very, very powerful alien strain that was in the royal dynasties of Egypt. So there's a lot of questions there. But yeah, Lemuria, it was known also as a rival civilization. And there's a lot of disinformation put out about that because, of course, people in control don't want you to know about that.
Does that, just to follow up about this, I mean, what about the... Are the archaeological remnants and actually the sort of mythos in Lemuria, in Polynesia, for example, on Easter Island, is the cult of the Birdman, and the giant Moai there, and of course the ruins of Nan Madol over there in Micronesia. Are these like possibly remnants of the ancient civilization?
Yes, there's no doubt in my mind. In fact, a lot of even the Mexican phenomena that's turning up now is sort of that new paranormal stuff coming out of Mexico. Absolutely, I believe that. You're very well informed, and I think that you're right. Especially, we know something's happening now because what was his name? The name's just slipped my mind. Jeff somebody or other, who was Jim somebody or other, who had gone out and discovered in ancient ruins in Bolivia recently.
His
name will come to me. He's had a couple of Discovery Channel shows on it. It's very interesting. I mean, he's discovered what I believe. He thinks he's discovered Atlantis because, of course, this is another perennial problem where people, every time they dig up some ancient place, they immediately say it's Atlantis without really knowing the background. I think what he's discovered there is a vast city complex that may have been related to Lemuria, not Atlantis.
Now, what got you into this, Michael? What made you say, hey, something's going on out there, and I want to investigate it further, and I want to see where it's going to take me? What was the starting point for you?
For me?
Yes.
It was in Ireland. It was, Ireland is, like I've always described it, as a temple or cathedral without walls. It is the oldest civilization in Europe, so it predates Egypt. It's literally, and this is well known to officialdom, that Ireland and Irish culture is the oldest in the world. And on the small continent of Ireland, I remember Ireland has always been called the Blessed or the Fortunate Isles. You know, we've even heard talk of the luck of the Irish. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff comes from the fact that Ireland and England, Scotland and Wales, were remnants of the lost continents of old. They survived. And so ever since, they were always known as the Blessed or the Fortunate Isles, simply for the fact that they had not sunk underneath the waves. Mm-hmm. So the remnants and the survivors of these lost continents, a lot of the highest magi ended up going to Ireland and setting up whatever remnant of the old Atlantean cultures that they had there. Some result of that is that, nowadays you can go there and see all these amazing megalithic sites and churches and temples and round towers and all of these things aligned to the constellations. And actually that's what got me started, is going there and looking at all of this stuff and obviously realizing that what these guides, that when you go there they have these guides from Trinity College University telling you the biggest load of bunk it obviously was just nonsense. And, you know, it was very clear then that there was a whole lie mechanism at work here to downplay this. And, of course, Ireland is a very, you know, Protestant Catholic country, and nobody in that country is comfortable looking back to the ancient pagan myths. So there they are sitting right on top of all of this stuff. But because of their conditioning from religion, they look at all of that as the devil's work, you know, and St. Patrick came to wipe it out. So there's not too much healthy scholarship, although there is some, about these ancient legends. So, and then what really triggered me was that in England, a lady called Catherine Maltwood discovered these enormous Earth zodiacs in England, just like it is the Nazca lines in Peru, where you can only see them from the air. Well, my God, she's discovering these enormous zodiacs that are only visible from the air. And then, you know, with all of the rest of the studies that have been done since the 70s on Glastonbury and Silbury Hill and Stonehenge and Newgrange, I mean, it was quite obvious that this was, you know, not what we were being told in history books. And then one thing just led to the other, and it was when I came to America and got involved with the work of Jordan Maxwell and a few others that all of it started to pull together. And I remember I had to almost come away from Ireland to see the mountain for what it really was. It was almost like when I was there, it was all foggy. I couldn't really grasp what, you know, the facts that were in front of me. And it was like when I came away to America, then you sort of have perspective. And then I could start to see, and then I started to cross-reference the Celtic legends with the mound builders of America, the Anasazi Indians, to which there's no explanation, you know, and start to realize that a lot of the artifacts that are being found in the mounds of America are Celtic in origin. I even worked with an archaeologist called Glenn Kimball. I don't know if you've had him on your show, but he's an American archaeologist who specializes in the mounds, especially the Ohio Mound in Ohio.
How do you spell his last name?
Say again?
His last name, Kimball? Kimball.
Yeah, Glenn Kimball. You can put him into a search engine. He's well known. He's a biblical expert. He's also written a lot of books on the Bible. And he had been abstracting artifacts, golden, you know, torques and golden necklaces and imagery. And he sent me photographs as a Celtic scholar to say, Michael, are we wrong? I mean, does this look to you like Celtic? And it was absolutely Celtic. It was Scandinavian. It was Celtic. And what the hell is it doing in American mounds? Well, the Anasazi Indian ruins, they claim that this Anasazi people, so-called, just appeared and disappeared. Yet you go down there, and the local Indians are telling you, no, they are not Indian. They are not of us who built this. Get this clear. But how come the Smithsonian and these other people still perpetuate the lie that it was Indian native individuals who built these amazing ruins down there in Casa Chica and Casa de Rinconada and the Anasazi ruins? No, these were visitors to these shores. The Indians know that and record that. But the power elite here, the status quo in America, doesn't want you to know that, you know, the Phoenicians and the Celts were in this country long ago. You're familiar with the theory of Quetzalcoatl and Kukulkan. How come it is that they say he's the blonde, blue-eyed god, you see, from the West?
That's true.
I mean, yeah, it's obvious when you know the reason.
And in South America, too, I think the Incas had a myth of Viracocha or something, who was also a tall, white-headed, pale, red-headed man.
Yeah.
And of course,
absolutely.
You know, absolutely. Just actually the legends here in North Carolina, actually, Prince Madoc or something like that. It was a Native American tribe that were pale and fair, you know, fair-skinned and light hair. So
absolutely. And you know who brought this a lot of this to light was another one of your most suppressed scholars, was Barry Fell. Barry Fell, who's a professor in linguistics and in writing and in archaeology, he literally discovered script. Yeah, I think it was in North Carolina. I can't remember where, but right in North America, he discovered scripts on the sides of walls that were Native American, people that thought were Native American, and he discovered that they were similar to the Ogham alphabet of Ireland. I mean, hands down, no questions asked. And immediately his work was suppressed. You know, in the turn of the century, in the 1800s, you had Augustus Laplanjon, the first man to go down there. And actually, if he hadn't have gone down there, we wouldn't know more about the Mayans than we do now. We actually know more about the Maya because he took rubbings and photographs of the ancient walls and the Mayan script that later on people went in and demolished on purpose. Okay, so he's the man that his books contain stuff that was lost within the same decade that he went down there, because there's a desperate campaign from the Royal Society of England and from the Vatican to make sure that individuals do not know that there was an early solar church, that there was ancient sun worshippers, you see, in all of this.
We got a caller.
Yeah, hang on just a second, Michael.
Sure.
Caller, where are you calling from? What's your question?
I'm from Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, hey there. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. I do have a quick question. Have you noticed that in almost all the paintings by the masters and in stained glass and things like that, that Mary is almost always painted as a redhead, and so is Jesus, Celtic, Irish? What do you think?
I heard that question. Yeah, this is again goes back to the whole concept of the Irish origins. of what was he talking about? He was talking about stained glass windows?
Are you still with us, caller?
Yes, I was watching a bunch of the programs on like History Channel and that this weekend as they were searching for the Holy Grail and in a number of these different programs and speaking the Da Vinci Code and all following
okay.
the whole line. And I noticed every time, because my youngest boy's a redhead and he gets picked on for it all the time, I said, look it, every time you look and you see Mary and Jesus, Mary's a redhead.
Yes, okay, I got you.
Noticing this, maybe I am, maybe I'm not, but I started out just kidding and... But every time we looked in there was a different painting by a different master or a different artist or in stained glass, her hair looked red.
Well, I'm a big believer, as you know if you've been following my work, that art and symbolism is probably one of the greatest ways, along with the interpretation of words, that's the best way to decode what was going on in ancient times. So the fact that you're interested in that, I salute that very strongly because it's in art and it's in pictorialization and it's in the history of words that we really find out what's been going on. And the redhead concept, see, in the Bible, they talk about Edomite. They talk about the Egyptians, the first Egyptians being Edomite. And then Judaic scholars admit that the word Edom actually means the redheads. And how come it is that all the Egyptian gods are painted as they're red? Well, isn't red what a white man's skin turns in tropical and hot climate?
Certainly. Yeah,
but Adam, also Adama, means red earth.
Means from the red earth. And this has not been addressed. There's been a lot of disinformation put out there about that to hide something that I'm working on in my new book, which is the West to East migration of civilization. The individuals that, and in China recently, the Paduric people and the Tocharian people who were discovered buried in Tartan, right, where they were Nordic people, the women's hair was red and golden, found in the wilds of China, where they even believe that the word China is a name given by these visitors from the West. We have to turn history on its head and get understanding about who were these civilizers so that these artists who knew this, the caller is referring to an artist who knew this, but he knew he couldn't say it, but he knew he could paint it. That how come the Middle Eastern so-called Mary Magdalene and how come the so-called Eastern Jesus Christ and all of his coterie had red hair and fair skin? And this is something that definitely needs to be looked into because the original story, the original Christ... And people can go to taroscopes.com and go to the astrotheology links, and there's a lot of information on this, were Western. And they were Western prototypes upon which the Eastern dramatis personae of the Bible were based. And this is something that in this year, you know, I'm working hard to extrapolate for people because we've been sold a bill of goods and a massive lie about the East to West movement of civilization. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Okay. Does that answer?
Go ahead.
Does that answer your question, caller?
Well, very well. I have another one, if I may.
Yeah, sure.
Sure,
no,
go ahead.
While on a mission in Ecuador, I noticed that many of the natives down there purposely try to dye their hair red.
Yeah.
Have you heard of that, and do you know if this may possibly be tied in as well?
Yes, it's the same thing in Tibet.
Culturally down there.
Yes, it's the same thing in Tibet. In Tibet, where the Celts also got to, and if you read Madame Blavatsky and the other sources, you know, they talk about this. The women have a ritual of dyeing their hair with patchouli oil in order to make it golden and red. Do you remember in Africa where there's rituals where they'll take white chalk and the men will actually completely cover their faces in white chalk in order to look white?
Yes.
Right? Because they're trying to emulate the gods and their dances and their ritual dances. In the Maori and Aboriginal culture, you also have this where the shaman will literally color his face red. Or white, in fact, where they talk about it. The Aboriginals have a group of people that were the gods who came from the West and who were white and who were tall and who were bringers of civilization. And they try to emulate them by wearing long hair that is either orange, you see in color, or yellow or red. This is a phenomenon that's all over the world, this concept of the Norsemen and the Scots and the Danes and the Celts. And not them specifically, but their ancestors, because we're talking about a long period, you know, B.C. What has happened is that a lot of people have confused things, especially the historians, because they want you to look at later migrations that did take place. I'm not saying that no migrations from the East took place, but these are migrations that are of far, far later date, after the sacking of the Temple of the Jerusalem in Rome by the Romans, you see, and many other migrations that took place because of drought and famine. But these are in the A.D. period. They start from 700 B.C. to about 1600 A.D. I'm talking about 5,000 years B.C. and probably more. And 11,000 years were the great civilizers of the great lost continents of Oceania and Lemuria, which was, of course, broken up. You can't have a pole shift and not have complete and utter chaos. where even your own people are scattered throughout the world, all trying to find each other. So there's a kind of a desire to congress, a desire to come together of all of these remnants of the same culture, the same people. And some people were able to find Ireland and the West and recall it, you know, re-get together, and others could not. Others could not pass the mountains and therefore set up in northern India and set up in Ceylon and set up in South America and Ecuador and these places, because they knew there's no way to re-find their original contingent, so they have to sit where they are and develop culture where they are. And then they marry in with the indigenous people that maybe they should find there, and of course being more sophisticated than the indigenous people that they find there. Later, the descendants try to, what would you say, keep alive some of the earlier anecdotes, which is why you find in northern India children to this day being born with blue eyes. All the Sikhs of northern India, if they were a little bit, if they came into the West and walked down a street in Scandinavia, they'd look perfectly Scandinavian. Aquiline faces, you know, tall height, thin build. The northern Indians are the Arya that are descended from the Aryan invasions, you see, of the past. And this, again, is being attacked now. Number one, the word Aryan has been completely ruined because, of course, we know the Second World War and all the lies that have been told about that term. That term has nothing to do with any political or group. It is an old, ancient name for the wise ones and the initiators of old, the sun kings. And more than that, we have the Indian Brahmins. The Brahmins are now in control of India, and so they are funding historians to try and downplay the Aryan invasion and to make the Aryans look like a bunch of, you know, marauders. But of course they can't do it successfully because we still have the Vedas, we still have the Upanishads, we still have the Puranas, and we still have these beautiful big buildings in India that are basically celestial calendars. And I go into this in my DVDs. So, you know, they can downplay it in history, but they can't remove the evidence of the great cities and the other anecdotes and idioms that these Aryans brought there, you see.
Okay.
But as time goes by, these truths are going to be erased if people don't start studying it.
Well, fantastic. Well, thanks for calling, caller.
Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, absolutely.
Thanks for listening.
Good night.
Good night.
All right. And,
yeah, good question.
Yeah. That number again is 800-960-2289.
Or
336-996-1596. Now,
you know, actually, there was a point I was going to make. I mean, there's so much stuff that you're just talking about, Michael. And, for example, one thing that I do remember in Indian mythology and history is one of my many sort of pastimes. There's a, I believe, a pillar in New Delhi,
yeah,
that's made out of a particular kind of metal.
Iron. It's pure iron.
Yeah, it's...
But it's a kind of iron that doesn't really rust.
Yeah, exactly. It's just standing there out in the middle of the street somewhere in New Delhi, and I guess this is perhaps an example of what you're speaking of.
And yeah, and there's another one. There's another one further up in the Himalayas, I think, in a remote place. And I think that, if I'm not mistaken, on the top of one of those pillars is a symbol of a lion.
I believe so, yes.
And the lion is always the symbol of the houses of Egypt, the solar houses of Egypt. So there's been a lot of migrations. I'm talking about very proto migrations, but of course, down through time, there's been Egyptians moving eastwards. We've got Indian tribes moving westward. You know, we've got a massive amount of interplay because of the droughts and the expansion of deserts and all of these kinds of things. So one has to distinguish the migrations of importance.
Oh yes, I remember, for example, they did an autopsy of the one of the mummies in Egypt, and they found, I think it was Ramses II, and they found trace elements of opium in his system. Now, if we take the traditional view of history, basically Egypt and where they grew opium would have nothing to do with each other. But I mean, opium developed out of Southeast Asia, you know. So,
haven't they also found tobacco and cocaine in the tombs of the mummies, which never should have been grown in those climes?
Exactly. I mean, that's basically what I'm getting at. So
they actually found pictures of elephants in South America where they claim the elephants have never been. No, the whole thing is shot to pieces. It's just that, you know, the masses don't know about it, and they don't know how they've been lied to. But even within science, many of the old, you know, lies that we've been told from the past have already been shot to pieces, especially about the pole shift and the flood. There's been many new researches in the last 10 or 15 years which completely explain all of these things, especially stuff that deals with the dramatis personae of the Bible. All of this has been explained, but a lot of people don't know this because a lot of people don't read, and therefore they're not aware that in the last just 10, 15 years, a lot of these major questions that have been bugging mankind for hundreds of years have been answered. You know, and my work in the DVDs especially is to try and synthesize them, since I know that people have no time to read, but they are very interested in these subjects. Then somebody must come along and synthesize all of that stuff in books and try to make it, you know, palatable and available to people who don't have the 25 years, you know, to do the research.
Oh, yeah.
And we address all of these things, you know. I've just finished producing this whole series of DVDs.
Okay.
That goes into all of the points that we're talking about.
Right. Well, we have to take a break here.
You can purchase those DVDs on your side?
Yeah, there's an easy way to go. I have several different websites, Jay. So if people just go to michaeltesarian.com, then they can use that page as a navigation page to get around the rest of the sites. My main site is taroscopes.com, for those who have a pen. And the DVDs are on Origins and Oracles. That's the name of the whole series, is originsandoracles.com. But if people have not got a pen and will forget those ones to write them down, then just go to michaeltesarian.com, and from that page you can easily, you know, surf all the rest of the pages.
Now, have I been pronouncing your name wrong the entire interview?
No, you got it right. It's with a T, T-S-A-R-I-O-N for people.
So is it Tesarian or is it Zarian? Oh, both. Okay. I wasn't sure. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Michael Zarian here on World of the Unexplained.
We're here with Michael Zarian.
Zarian. You still with us, Michael?
Yeah, it's right here.
Okay, great. Okay. Let's talk about Atlantis some, okay? Because I'm interested in the technology. The technological aspect. I know I've read some of David Hatcher Childress's book about technology of the gods and things of that nature. How technologically advanced do you think that civilization was?
Oh, I think, at least 1,000 years ahead of where we are now. I'm a big fan of David's work. And I think that, Michael Cremo has also shown that there's been artifacts of tremendous sophistication. I mean, obviously, nobody can build a pyramid today. So even if you just take the pyramid as a single example, I mean, there's many more. But even if you just take the pyramid as an example, it's bewildering the kind of level of technology that existed in the past. And these were beings that obviously, clearly, did not establish this kind of technology while they were here on this planet. It's obvious that it was brought here. And so that some of these buildings and the technology that we're talking about and the underground caves that Van Duneycken has shown were lasered out. I mean, basically lasered out. They were so perfectly cut. And all of those kinds of anomalies, like the crystal skull I'm thinking of, and just fact that they know that maps of the Earth existed, which could only have been taken from the air. All of these anomalies clearly show that there was enormous sophistication here, and it would have continued. Uh-huh. It's just that the variable was that when these individuals on Atlantis and Lemuria had such a ferocious war between themselves, that the Earth itself erupted with violence of its own, and this caused the sinking of the great continents, of the furore and the ferociousness of the war. And neither contingent had any idea that this was going to be happening. And therefore, it's just like, you know, the old Superman image when you see Superman. Superman. I mean, look at the incredible subliminal information in that movie about a Superman who comes from another planet who's got supernatural abilities, and then he's part human, part alien, you know, and he goes to his temple precinct up in where? Where does he go? The extreme north into the ice. You see, we're being told something in those movies. And when he gets there, of course, what is his computer all made out of? It's all crystalline technology. So I think that those are made on purpose. Those films are showing us what life was like at one time, and that there was this kind of sophisticated computer technology. The Celtic, the most ancient legends of Ireland talk about the king having his arm replaced by a silver arm. I mean, to this day, the High King of Ireland...
Lieu of the Light Arm or something, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, and all of these, the Cauldron of Power, which is almost like a cryogenic type of chamber that preserved life or even restored life. We have a lot of things that have long been taken for folk tales, fairy mythology, and just sci-fi, you know, fantasy nonsense. We have to start realizing that, no, now because we've regained a lot of our technological ability, we're on a different kind of pedestal. So that when we look back at the times of the past and look at these myths and legends, we can take them more seriously. I think that's what my work is also doing, is we have to now start taking seriously because we're almost developing back some of the things that were spoken of in ancient times.
Oh, yeah. Now, what do you make of in your native Ireland, the Tuatha De Danann, and at some point they left Ireland or something like that, and then there's a sort of correlation maybe that they're the same things, the leprechauns or the fae? I mean,
This is an interesting topic. I don't know for sure if it is a sort of a corruption of the story by later Christian monks, or if there's actually something to it. For people who don't know, what you're talking about are the giant druid magi of Ireland, the Gaels. These are the high priests of all the races in Ireland, who then, after they were defeated in war, decided to change their shape and go into the earth and to, you know, have a smaller size, and became the fairy people. And that's quite true, except for the interpretation of the word fairy doesn't mean a lot of what people think it means. The word fairy just meant, you know, a person of power or magical ability. Like these individuals were able to inhabit some other kind of form, like a more of a light body. And of course, people still say they see these. I mean, in Ireland, it's 100% believed. You know, people believe all of this. And there may be something to it. Or it may be that this is a sort of a twisting of the actual story by later Christian interpreters. I still haven't really decided yet. But the people that you speak about are definitely existed and are responsible for many of the great earthworks there. I know where some of the kings are buried of that group that you mentioned. And they definitely existed. You know, and as to their fading away later on, there seems to be some contamination with that story. So, you know, it's hard to believe. We don't know exactly what to believe.
Okay, I've got a question from somebody in the chat room. Let's see, it started way up here. Let's see, he was talking about, asking if there could be a correlation between the ancient civilization destroyed by God in Genesis and the ancient civilizations he's talking about. It says Genesis talks about that race being corrupted and evil, a product of demons breeding with human women, etc. I want to know his take on that possibility, how it can tie in. And then he says, as far as sinking, like Atlantis, many of the lands were flooded in the Great Flood, and Genesis never resurfaced. If there was a correlation there, and saying that if some of those lands that were mentioned as being flooded in Genesis, would that be what we would refer to these days as Atlantis?
Sinking. Yeah, no doubt about it.
Okay.
In fact, it's very clear that there was hybridization, because the descriptions of Lilith, for instance, sons of Cain, you know, they make blatant mention in the Bible itself and in many of the books that were part of the old Christian library that, of course, were not put into the Bible, like so many books, the Book of Jasher, the Book of Jubilees, the Book of Baruch, the Forgotten Gospels of Adam and Eve, all of these ancient, the Book of Enoch, they all talk about the hybridization question. And
Enoch, that's from the Apocrypha, right?
Yeah, okay. All the apocryphal works talk about this, and they talk about the fact that there was the giants. Now, the word that they use in the Bible is Nephilim, and that's been mistranslated. It does mean those who were cast down, so obviously it talks about it. It's the same meaning as the word Anunnaki.
Okay.
The word Anunnaki merely comes from two word roots, An, Ki. An is heaven, and Ki is earth. So it meant those who came from heaven to earth, the fallen ones. It means those who are cast down. But one of the most interesting meanings of the word Nephilim is those who bring down, those who cause fall. Now, this is very, very important. One of the other meanings of the word Nephilim is those who cause man to fall. And therefore, when these Nephilim beings started to interfere with the biology of the people they found here, that is what the real fall is their genetic interference with Mother Nature, with the idea that they interfered with the people here. Now, 50,000 years ago, when they arrived, that's when you had the flood. So we have to distinguish between the flood, and we have to distinguish between the later pole shift. There were about 30, there were almost 40,000 years apart. About 35,000 years apart. So what's happened, because we're looking back, we fused the two events together, and what we have to do now is separate them. Because the flood took place about 50,000 years ago, when the planet, the 12th planet in our system, Tiamat, was destroyed by the pursuers of the Nephilim. And I go into that in the book. It would be too long-winded to go into now. Okay. But there was a planet up there, the remnants of which is the asteroid belt. And that planet is known by scientists to have been there, and it is known to have been destroyed some way. But my thesis is that it was actively destroyed by humanoid intervention. That planet was 15 times larger than the Earth. 15 times larger than the Earth. And it was mostly an ocean planet. So the flood that we're talking about, when they say that the earth stood still and the rain never stopped for 40 days and, you know, there was just pummeling debris, we're talking about something that didn't happen on Earth, but waters that literally, cryogenically frozen, re-entered our atmosphere through the Roche field and fell to Earth as the 40 days of rain. The water of the flood is not even Earth water. It's even conceded that the Earth didn't have many oceans on it prior to 50,000 years ago. This is another lie that's been put in front of us by science. So the waters that came in were from this destroyed planet that was just basically our next-door neighbor up there in space.
Huh.
Now, the pole shift that took place from the war of the gods was so ferocious that it did tip the Earth. It made the Earth move off of its normal axis. And because of the disturbance magnetically,
it caused another ice age.
It caused major upheaval, yeah. And it also caused some of the same remnant that was still up there of the debris, and by the way, that debris is still up there. When the Earth was careering off of its orbit, not only did you have a pole shift situation, but it sucked some some more of the debris from Tiamat back into the orbit. So you had a bit of both.
Hey, Michael, I've got another caller. Hang tight just a second
here.
Hello, caller. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
My name is Laura. I'm calling from Kansas.
Oh, hey, Laura.
Hey, Laura.
Hi. I wanted to ask Michael, I know that many countries and continents have their own creation myth, and years ago I had sort of a vision of my own of a particular creation story, and in doing the research I found that it closely associated with the myth of Europa. I just wondered if Ireland itself has anything that's close to that particular myth, or if they have a specific one that has to do with another being coming and planting, a seed to create a race.
Oh yeah, they do. All the Scandinavian myths, I believe, are the oldest myths. I believe that the Scandinavian myths and the Irish myths of Europe are the oldest myths that talk about this stuff. And Europa, the word Europa, actually means from the flame. Did you know that?
From the flame?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it actually means, it's a goddess, obviously, from the flames. Meaning what flames? The flames we've been talking about. The utter chaos and destruction of the old world, which sank the five ancient continents. The next lands were given names like Blessed Isles, Fortunate Isles, and then Europa actually means she who arose from the ancient flames. That's what the very word means in Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what we see now, the splitting of the different races that we're maybe more familiar with now, this is all the sort of displacement of the original racial groups that now were scattered, you know, far and wide, some of which, as I say, tried to coalesce again, and others who were very unsuccessful. And that's why you find Aryan groups here, and then thousands of miles away, you find a kindred group, and you find Mongoloid people in America, and then you find them in Tibet. What's going on here? It's because these were all once probably, you know, connected groups, all one homogenous grouping, but then because of the earth changes, they were all scattered and separated, and all we have now is that their myths and their legends and their dances and their language, perhaps, and some of their customs are connected. But, of course, we have a power elite in the world who don't want you to know about what we're talking about. So they have then concocted histories to try and just completely confuse the hell out of everyone about why there are these connections. They don't want you to see the truth. So they come in there with all of their welter of lies and nonsense so that the human race is befuddled. And, of course, the human race has only been literate for, what, 50, 100 years? Our forefathers just one or two generations ago were laboring illiterately in the fields. So it was very easy for the last 11,000 years to say whatever they wanted, to preach it in Latin so nobody could have a faintest idea what was talking about,
mm-hmm.
and to contort and control history, to send out massive armies like the Roman armies and massacre everybody who had the truth, to colonize and annihilate, to have campaigns of genocide, and then to later open their own schools so that the rest of us are taught whatever they tell us to believe. So there's been an absolute... I'm actually constantly amazed that we even are able to put things together even now after this campaign of destruction. I'm amazed that we're even able to do it at all, because of the enormous genocide. Ireland, for instance, my goodness, you know, we could not even go into the genocide that has happened in that land that even the Irish people, believe it or not, are unfamiliar with. They have no idea, most of the Irish people, of the utter, you know, millennia-old campaign of destruction, not just through the Romans, but before and after, that have been perpetrated on that land to make sure that the true story of the Druids does not come out.
Hmm.
And it's been the same in every indigenous race, every indigenous people.
Hmm. Oh, okay.
Well, thanks, Laura.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling in.
Oh, yeah. Thanks so much. That was very interesting.
All right.
Fantastic.
Bye-bye.
That was Laura from Full Moon Radio. She does another show on our network. Actually, I think you're going to be on her show later, aren't you?
That's right. That's right. Exactly so.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Where to get from... We could really just go on and on and on about talking about the myths.
Well, I want to talk more about the technology, though. I want some specifics.
Okay, yeah.
Do you know? I mean, do you have any idea? I mean, are we talking about electricity here? Are we talking about cars? Are we talking about airplanes, spaceships? I mean, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, I think that I can recommend, you know, David Hatchett-Childress. I mean, Michael Cremo's Forbidden Archaeology. We're talking about the technology that built the pyramids, that had navigation abilities. Obviously, the people who once knew how to, you know, space travel, even though you may have lost a lot of your computers and your hardware and your weaponry, you still have a lot of intelligence upstairs in the brain. And so even though you may not have the hardware, you can still put together some rudimentary weapons. you can still put together some, you know, the rod of iron that they talk about in the Bible. There's a lot of veiled information about technology actually in the Bible if you read it, about the rod of iron and striking down the enemies with these trumpets of power. I believe that those were primitive guns, actually based on the kind of technology. This was first brought up by the English scholar Commons Beaumont, who spoke extensively about the use of weaponry. And, of course, that's all been hidden. It's hidden in the basements of the Smithsonian and many of these other institutes. They hide all of this information. They downplay it so that we're not meant to know this, that the great Mahabharata talks about, you know, spacecraft and firing missiles at one another, and all sorts of implements of war.
Where's this going, though? What is the agenda? What is the bottom line? What's being tried to accomplish here?
Well, the vacation of the planet. I think very simply, I think because obviously we know that they're controlling us and dumbing us down, but those are not means to an end. I mean, what would be the purpose of doing that? No. Behind the cryogenics, behind the cybernetics, behind the whole movement of technology, which, I remember, we understand that movement sort of hit a peak during what we call the Renaissance. But the word Renaissance means rebirth.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Rebirth, all right, for them. It was the first moment in history, not for us, but for them. They were the ones patting themselves on the back at that time, because now they were getting a handle. Look at all those drawings of Leonardo da Vinci, and there's been many others that have been suppressed. That was the moment in time where it looked like to the Brotherhood of the Nephilim that they were starting to see the first signs of the rebuilding of the technology. That has come down to us in the public idiom as the Renaissance. Yeah, but all of that stuff was for a reason. That's that technocratic elite that have been working overtime for 11,000 years to get some semblance of technology back. But what does that mean? That meant having to put the whole earth under control, to dig, to find the mine, you know, the mining, to subjugate whole peoples, to put on shipping lines and huge trade routes. We have to understand that there's an occult agenda in conquest and in colonization. It's not just because some greedy people in the smallest country in the world, England, decided one day, you know, that they're shivering in their castles and they decide to go out to the wildest places in the world and send their armies there. That's a total bogus lie. They had an agenda to amass all of the ores and all of the different kinds of artifacts that they would need in order to centralize and build up the kind of technology and move people forward. The Renaissance stands out, but it's been going on ever since. Our industrial age, the agricultural age, and now the Silicon Age, these are a movement in history by people who couldn't give a damn about the spiritual uplift or maturation of the human race, who don't care if we are seething in a hotbed of emotional turmoil. You know, they just give us drugs for that. They don't care if we're at each other's throats, murdering, warring, killing, brutalizing, living our own personal lives in depression and confusion. They didn't care about our forefathers who slaved in factories for them, who died on the field for them, who got murdered in hideous wars for them. They are moving relentlessly forward to one agenda, and that is to vacate this planet. And Paul Allen and Microsoft and SRI and MIT and all of these groups, the Hoover Institute, SRI, most of the groups that you can think of that are these massive, just by the symbolism alone, the serpentine symbolism that is used in Sun Corporation, the apple with a bite out of it from Genesis that Apple have been using, the symbolism alone tells you that there's an occult agenda. Gateway. Gateway to what, buddy? Gateway that Intel always showing a half-open door is like leading out of some place. We need to be able to decode the Masonic symbolism that they're showing, that technology is based on an idea of unlocking a key, just like they show you in Stargate, because they're desperate to get out of here. I brought this up because I think it's very important that because there's four different scenarios that I talk about in the book that could happen, four different outcomes, one of them being that they do get off this planet. And, of course, we need to know what will happen because we might be, the future of the human race is dependent on what happens in this higher coterie. We're heading for a Maya end date of the 2012. Time may be very short based on the different theories that are out there.
What's your take on that, 2012 date?
Well, on my DVD that I did about it, I canvassed some of the most important, because remember, there's many theories. And I think that two or three of the theories are very interesting, and that is that one is that they're claiming that the Earth and the solar system itself passes through a sort of an ionized field of photonic energy. Now, photons are known. Photons are the highest form of light that exists materially. I mean, we all know what light is, and the sunlight and what have you. Uh-huh. But photons, which are, you know, as you know, created from the electron spin, are the highest form of light that we can ever know about. Now, there are belts of this kind of radiation that science discovered, and then it was quickly silenced because, of course, of the consequences of that. And it's almost like a spin-dry cycle for the solar system. The solar systems are moving through space, and they pass cold zones, and they pass hot zones, and it's just like driving your car, you know? So they're claiming that one of the interpretations is, and there's a lot of credence to this, that the whole solar system may be passing through a highly ionized field of this photonic energy. But light is light is light. And light has always been connected to spirituality, not just in the Bible, but in all the ancient mythologies. So, what would happen then if some of the most toxic beings, criminalistic, Luciferian types of entities and beings on this planet, those who have wallowed in blood for aeons, can't take this kind of light, because the light is infusion into our solar system, if you believe the stories, and I didn't invent this, I'm just commenting on it, that they do have a major shift in consciousness or on the cellular level of the human being. Well, then we know that these, you know, creatures that rule the planet, they're not going to be able to stomach this. So perhaps they're in acceleration now because they know that in 2012 the options are no longer theirs, that Mother Nature is going to be coming in with her broom to take care of the filth. So there may be this need then, you see, to accelerate and accelerate and accelerate what's going on now. That's one theory. The other theory concerns Western astrology. It's a very similar concept as the Maya are talking about, is just in a Western way, which is that we're coming towards the end of the age of Pisces, meaning that we're moving into the famous age of Aquarius. But if we can just step aside from all the New Age hoopla for a moment and just notice this thing as an astrological phenomena, is that when we come to the end of any age, there is a period of cleansing. And could this be then that the Maya, when they were talking about the age of revealing that would start in 1999 and be a countdown of 13 years to 2012, could we be in that age of revealing or that age of apocalypse or that age of revelation, and that in 2012, you know, we'd move into a different kind of way of living and way of being? And so I think that that's very, very accurate, because if you track back to the age of Taurus, the age of Aries, you see, you go backwards. And you find that, yes, at the end of every one of the astrological ages, and each age lasts about 2,000 years, there has been tremendous upheaval in the world during those times. Now, it's made worse in our age because we're at the end of the age of Pisces. But what is Pisces? Pisces is the end of the zodiac. So we're not just at the end of an age, we're at the end of the age. The end, Pisces, as any astrologer knows, and you can look this up on the internet for people who are not familiar, Pisces is the 12th house of the zodiac, the last one. So we are entering the end of the last age of Pisces. And therefore, I believe that all the prophets, both modern, from Edgar Cayce all the way back to the ancient Maya, who talked about the, you know, coming of a revelation or coming of an apocalypse or a time of tribulation or whatever, it was very much to the end of the age of Pisces that they're talking about. And this concerns me deeply, because I am already seeing the changes. And I think anybody with half a brain cell can see that there's something really remarkable going on in the psyche of human beings, in the political, militaristic climate, both good and bad. And I think that now, specifically to talk about my work, is very much focused on what we're likely to see starting from when? November of this year, as a matter of fact. Because let's look at it time-wise, right, timeline-wise. The Maya said that 1999 was the beginning of the age of revelation, or the age of revealing, or the age of apocalypse.
Okay.
November 8th, 2003 was the halfway point, I believe. Could be wrong, but I think that was the halfway point. We've already passed by that. So then what happens? Well, astrologically, the planet Pluto, which is the planet of apocalypse, because you have many planets up there and many representatives of what we're talking about. But Pluto is the planet that rules what lies hidden. So I'm just using astrological jargon because I come from that field, but don't get put off, don't your listeners get put off because I'm using astrological jargon. These are scientific facts as well. These are psychological truths. I'm just using astrological jargon to make myself clear. The planet Pluto crosses galactic center in November of this year. So if anything goes into overdrive of this age of revelation, it begins this year. And I think that a lot of people on a deep level know that.
Okay.
I think it's going to be also provable later on because of different changes that are also happening in the frequency of the Earth waves, the Schumann waves, the Hertzian frequency of the Earth, the Hartmann waves, the Schumann waves, and it's going to be showing psychologically. I believe it already is. And as we move forward past this galactic center point, when the planet Pluto, which is the slowest moving planet in the zodiac, it takes 250 years to go around the whole zodiac. When it is the crossing galactic center, it's almost like a black lens is put in front of a light. It's like the microscope of the divine surgeon, you know, like the psychic hygienist. Is now the microscope is pointing on everybody. We're already feeling it, by the way, because planet Pluto being slow moving, we even feel that energy even months and even years before it sort of crosses galactic center because of the slowness of the move. But when it starts to move towards, September, October, November, and then December, we're going to see mighty changes, and we're going to feel them inwardly, and that process is going to extend for the whole of 2007. So we are right now on the cusp of the overdrive point where there's no going back. And therefore, people need to get their lives in order. They're going to have to start looking at the darker aspects of their mind and not be afraid of that and not think there's something negative about it. More importantly, they're going to have to be familiar and be sort of prepped for massive psychic changes that are going to happen in the people around them, people that they've trusted, people that they think they love, people that they have given, you know, they're in partnership with in business, and so on. There's a whole psychological, social, domestic, you know, aspect to all of this. Because we're going to have some masks coming down, and that's going to scare the hell out of a lot of people, both protagonist and antagonist.
I want to talk about that as far as the psychic changes. But right now we're going to have to go to another break. We're on with Michael Zarian and World of the Unexplained.
We'll be back.
We'll be right back after this from the Goo Goo Dolls. Hang tight, guys. We'll be right back. And we're back with Michael Zarian. Tarotscopes.com is the website. You can also call us here and speak with him or us, and us, live here, 800-960-2289 or 336-996-1596. Both of those numbers are on our website at www.worldoftheunexplained.com. And you can also go to omnisoundradio1.net. That's our network that we run from. You can check that out and go into the chat room there or on the World of the Unexplained site. Right now the chat room's filling up a bit. Please feel free to jump in and enjoy the conversation if you're a little shy about calling in. Michael, you still with us?
Yes, indeed, Jay. Still here.
Okay, great. I want to talk about some of these psychic changes that you're saying that you were talking about happening to people that we know. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you see, it does go back. The origin of it is obviously, you know, it has a date of birth. The genetic interference, which I believe brought the instinct for evil into our being, that does date back from the early times that we're talking about. So when we're talking about any kind of cruelty or injustice or difficulty psychically, you know, what we're basically talking about is that human being is a schizoid entity. This schizophrenia is not something that was a bestowal of God, and it was not just something that happened, you know, through a freak of nature. This was tampering with the laws of nature in pretty much recent historical times, and we're now left with a legacy of that. I think that this is part of the reason why it is that the Maya and others were talking about that, you know, life can't go on perpetually like that. This interference was recent in history, and it may in fact be coming to its close. Because remember, whatever you have inside your mind psychically is what makes your society. It's what makes history. History and consciousness are connected. Inner mental energy and external energy are connected. We may not have been taught about those connections, but they exist nevertheless, as the quantum scientists have shown. So could it not be that the changes that we're having in our psychology is actually manifesting our own destiny outside of ourselves, and that, you know, our consciousness is coming to the end of one kind of life? Maybe the ego, which came about as a reaction to the terrible devastation and trauma that our forefathers, you know, experienced in previous ages. Maybe the ego has a life of its own, just like the ancient Vedas talk about the life of Brahma, the day and the life of the yugas, that the cycles come and the cycles close. I believe that we're very much entering a cycle which is not just physical in nature, like we were talking in the last segment. It's not just to be considered something on the physical time clock. We may be coming to the close of one kind of psychic life, and I very much believe that this was what the Maya were really trying to talk about. They were talking about not just the shadow of a time dial changing. They were talking about the kind of life that we have been living for so long, a life based on tremendous cruelty and injustice.
So do you believe that the world will end in 2012?
I believe that the world as we know it will end, and I think it's more like the lifestyle we'll be living will end. Because remember, nature never dies. It's only the ego of man who thinks that he can change nature. You may modify nature, you may destroy it, you may appear to destroy nature, but nature itself can never be destroyed. All that will happen is man will have the opportunity to, you know, sink in a morass of his own degeneracy. So yeah, and the way things are going, I have no problem seeing that as being the end of 2012. No problem at all. I think the injustices are mounting up, and there would be what we might want to call a judgment day type of situation coming along. Or it might take on some other form. See, the psychic tyranny that we have inside is not only caused by the ancient genetic interference of our hidden masters, it is nowadays also of use to the hidden masters. It's also now used by them. The fact that we're in a state of inner chaos, you see, an inner deremption, and inner confusion, is also manipulated by those who want to keep us all in a sort of a ordo ab chao, you know, chaotic type of situation. It serves them no end to keep us dumbed down, confused, you know, and not able to really live the sovereign lives that we're meant to be living.
Now, you mentioned something that wasn't from God. Now, how do you define God? What kind of religious stance do you take?
Well, I prefer not to get into that at all, because that is the one area that will really cloud the issue when you're working in the field that I do. So I tend to completely avoid, you know, and the people who've read my Atlantis book, many of them have commented about that. Why did you not, you know, talk about the metaphysical or divine aspect? And that's because, look, you know, I didn't want to cloud the issue. This subject is already controversial enough in the book,
yeah.
And I wanted to keep it as clean as possible so that people are not able to, you know, you have the normal, you know, hooks and labels that are these sort of comfort zone type of attitudes. I think we have to reevaluate and reappraise all our belief systems. And so if I'm not the first person to do that, how can I demand anybody else to do it?
Well, no, that's what I'm asking. I mean, how has this changed? I'm assuming you were brought up either Protestant or Catholic, being from Ireland, and I could make that could be a wrong assumption, but how has that changed your viewpoint?
Well, I was brought up actually more like atheist in a way, because my father was a very staunch Marxist, as a matter of fact.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Well, how about that?
He was a very unusual person who had some very bizarre beliefs, and he was an extreme left-wing Marxist, very active in Irish politics. My mother, of course, was a Sikh. She was from northern India, but they were also more like not really practicing Sikhism necessarily as a full-blown religion.
Uh-huh.
And she went through her hippie days, you know, the bohemian days, and was pretty much a hippie for a long time in the sense of not having a, you know, she was, I think, a spiritual kind of person, but not necessarily, you know, having a religious concept. So, yeah, well, I went to Protestant school. So any of the religious training I would have had, it would have been from Christianity.
Okay, and I'm assuming that's changed after all the research that you've done, or?
I don't know. I actually consider myself still a Christian. I think that even if the rest of the world would totally not consider me a Christian, I think I am a Christian because, you know, my reading of what Christianity is, which is fighting evil,
uh-huh.
and knowing about principalities of great power, I think I'm, you know, fitting into that well. I don't belabor it. I don't care what other people think because, as I said to you earlier, this evil that we're fighting long predates the rise of Muhammad and Jesus Christ. So, you know, I believe that it's like a giant army, and we're waiting. You know, the Christian contingent are like a Christian legion. Uh-huh. And the Muslims are a Muslim legion. It's like we're all fighting evil. We're not, but it's not a Christian fight. It's a gigantic fight that's been going on for a long period of time by members of the occult orders and people outside of Christianity. But you know, we need to put these differences together and realize we're all very healthy contingents within each other that should not be fighting within each other. You know, a lot of Christians I'm very much in favor of who've written some fantastic books exposing the conspiracy in America. Many of them are friends of mine. I've been on their radio shows. I have no problem with those Christians who are addressing the problem of the Illuminati and the world system and the royal elites and all of these other, you know, factors that deal with the destruction of American sovereignty. A lot of them are Christian writers. I have no problem with that. I'm a great fan of James Bogreitz and Eustace Mullins and everybody else. In fact, my work couldn't exist without their work. So, you know, I'm looking at it all as like we are all separate contingents, and we can all have our separate tents and our separate encampments, you know, and we can have our own armor and our own symbols and our own standards. But let's never forget that we're all facing the same enemy, you know, across the hills, across the mountain.
Huh. Well, we've got about 3 minutes. Yeah, I know. We'd love to have you back on sometime in the future, Michael. This has been a great show.
You have a great show yourself, so I'll definitely be open to that.
All right,
fantastic.
Great. But what do you want to say? What are your final words?
Final
words. 3 minute recap. Obviously, watch the show.
Right. July 9th.
Yeah.
Right?
You know, people, MichaelTessarian.com, they can go on and browse all that I'm doing. I will be on Sci Fi Channel on July 9th. It'll be at Conspiracy Con conference in the Bay Area, which is a fantastic conference. A lot of what we've been talking about in this show, I have a free web stream on the Taroscope site. If they go to the web stream page, there's a web stream there for 2 hours long called The Origins of Evil that we provided for free.
Oh, wow.
That was filmed at last year's Conspiracy Con, and we have a lot of very interesting stuff there that we've also been talking about here. So if people want more of an appetizer before they come to Conspiracy Con, or, you know, they can go to my website. There's some free web stream there, and they can definitely get more of a handle on exactly who I am and what I'm doing in relation to. Because, again, what I would say is that, yes, ancient history is very, very important, and it is an interesting subject, but my motive for studying these things in ancient times is a very passionate interest in what is happening today. My interests are in what is happening militaristically and psychologically and socially today. That's where my focus is. I'm not just going to be put into a category of some, you know, historian, and we need not listen to what he has to say. My concerns are with the human race and what we've been doing in the past, but why we're living the kind of strange life we're living now. So, there's, you know, I'm very much into solutions, as to solving the problems, because we're going to come upon a time now which is going to be very shocking to a lot of people, and it's going to pull the foundations out from under a lot of people. And if they are, even if they're not disseminators of dark energy, say that you're not a generator or you're even a disseminator of dark energy, you still need to be aware of what's going to happen around you so that you don't go off your rocker, you know, and that you have a strong center. Because very bizarre things are going to be happening in the future, and the people of the light need to know about it. And they also need to know about those reactions of, that might be happening within them, and not misinterpret those inner conflicts that start to arise in front of them. Because there's a lot of diagnosis needs to be understood right now, so people are prepped for the times ahead.
Hmm. Yeah, you learn, your future is guided by learning from your past, basically.
Yes. And, see, tomorrow, we'll never have ever certainty about tomorrow. No matter how much science progresses, man can never have certainty about the world of tomorrow. But through the right kind of study, he can definitely know where he's been and what has been happening in the past. And that is what is helping him in his life today, you know?
Well
said, well spoken. And check out a site, terrascopes.com or michaelzarian.com, and you can get more information on our website. There's a link there provided at www.worldoftheunexplained.com.
And the TV show is on July 9th, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Let me thank you, both of you guys, for this opportunity. 2 hours is a good, you know, we can get into a lot of material, so thank you for that time.
Well, thank you for coming on the show, Michael.
Most welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Michael Zarian.
Michael Zarian.
Either way, he said. So.
That was just a great show.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, the show's not over,
well,
guys.
You know, I'm writing a book right now I'm working on.
Are you really?
I am. And it's all about some of the stuff that we've been talking about on the show and how my weirdo idea of how it all fits together.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, everybody's got their own weirdo idea, and I've got mine now, and I've been, and every guest we get that builds on
you
it.
You sort of add a little more to it.
Yeah, well, yeah, it builds on what I've already said, what I've already been thinking about. So we're going to be offering that book actually on the website here later when I finish. It's going to be a while before it's done.